Thank you for having me.
You are study the history of botany. What would that entail, the history of botany, for those who are unaware?
Yes. Basically, I am a classicist, so my first degree is in Greek and Latin, and I studied the ancient texts from Theophrastus, the father of botany, in the 3rd century BC, and I am trying to see if we can bring together classical philology, history, and also contemporary botany in order to identify these plants and to see what these texts have to tell us about biodiversity, for example, in the Old World.
Very interesting. Who were the herbalists in the early centuries that you have come across?
Oh yeah, there are many people, some whom we know by name and probably many anonymous. But for example, in Theophrastus, we have these phrases by him in which he says that he tried to collect knowledge from the people in the field, and he mentioned some doctors who have found, or claimed to have found, miraculous remedies, but also he says that he got in touch with the shepherds, for example, to know what are their secrets. And so basically what we are talking about is a whole crowd of people who practiced the art of botany and art of healing, and whose knowledge has been collected by ancient scientists and written down, and these are the texts we still have now.
Did they practice other forms of healing along with the plant medicine?
Yes, medicine was not as monolithic as it may be now, even though right now there is a huge movement towards herbs. But ancient medicine brought together a lot of streams, and herbs was one of these components in this stream. But there were also religious medicine, temple medicine which consisted in going to the temple of Asclepius, sleeping within the temple, and having during the night a dream with the revelation of the treatment. So it was Asclepius who appeared to the patients, laying down on the ground and telling them what they should do to treat their disease. So there is a first form, in a certain sense, of psychoanalytic treatment. And there is a very famous patient for that, Elius Aristides, a Roman of the late antiquity, who had a certain number of health problems, and he visited the temples of Asclepius, and he wrote down his own experience.
I heard a story of, I think it was around 1000 AD, that there was a temple in Italy, and women would go there, and the temple was filled with snakes, and they would go inside, and the snakes would tell them what plants they would need to heal themselves. Have you heard of a similar story?
Let's say this kind of story is an epiphenomenon of the Asclepius medicine, because indeed in the temples of Asclepius there were snakes on the ground, and there has been some 15 years ago a researcher, a team actually of researchers in Italy, who made a study about this phenomenon. And it seems that the snakes, when licking the wounds of patients, have indeed some properties in order to clean and close these wounds. So there is some cell reactivation. So it may be the case that this temple medicine might have been some efficacy.
That's incredible.
Yes.
Now, was this the herbalists who practiced this type of medicine, were they part of the mainstream medicine, or was this more alternative or more of a fringe part of the medical field at that time?
No, medicine, the core of ancient medicine was exactly this herbal medicine, and we have a proof of that. The herbs which were used for the treatment of the ailments of the patients are exactly the same as those one which were used in nutrition, they were foodstuff. And so there is a deep link between nutrition and medicine. And so on top of that, these plants used as foodstuff and medicines were common plants, which people could find in the orchard. And so we can consider that this kind of medicine was really the basic family medicine, the core of ancient medicine. And already the Hippocratic physicians, which are the physicians who practiced medicine according to the philosophy of Hippocrates, claimed that medicine and food are exactly the same thing. And they have a way of saying that food is medicine, medicine is food. And so this is really the core of ancient medicine.
Well, that was I was going to ask you how they differentiate between food and medicine, and it seems like they didn't. So did they make a difference between medicine and what we would now classify as illicit drugs?
That's a tricky question, not because it's tricky in itself, but because the Greeks, for example, and also the Romans, tricked on this point. The mainstream historiography, contemporary historiography, claims that ancient civilization is perfectly rationalist, and so that there wasn't any use of any psychoactive substances. However, I have started doing my research on treatises which are now labeled as toxicology, venoms and poisons.
Mm-hmm.
And significantly, in these treatises on poison, there are all the substances that we know identify as psychoactive. And when you read carefully these texts, you see that these ancient physicians knew perfectly the effects of these substances, and they were perfectly aware also of the differentiation in the effects of these substances according to the dosage. The point is that there is nothing which appears in the literature, the arts, or any other source. So there is no explicit reference to that. And all this information is in treatises of toxicology, which are actually the negative effects of the natural substances. And so it seems that there was a general a priori approach to these substances as something negative, but we don't have any information about their use. So it's, on the one hand, very clear that they knew they used them because they described their effects, but on the other hand, we don't have any explicit information. And so we have to conclude that it was in some way hidden, not recognized as such.
Mm-hmm. So what about something such as the Eleusinian Mysteries?
That's exactly this kind of question. There are people who claim that these were collective phenomenon of intoxication, let's say, and others who approach these mysteries more as a real religious phenomenon. And the major proponent of the theory of collective hallucination, to speak quickly, even though we should discuss this then. But let's say the major proponent of the theory has been the Swiss pharmacochemist Albert Hofmann,
mm-hmm.
who discovered the LSD. And so this is a question which is still open. And it really depends on the way you approach the ancient history. Either you are a historian of religion and you are interested in tracing the mystical experience of people, or you approach it more from the viewpoint of pharmacohistory, and you may propose the drug path, let's say. But we don't have any physical evidence.
Mm-hmm. Were there plants at that time that were demonized, such as we demonize certain plants in our culture?
Yes and no. Yes, because, of course, there were in all cultures. You have that? No, because when you read carefully these ancient works I read, you see that you have a real encyclopedia of all the plant world. But it's clear that a plant like mandrake, for example, which is now perfectly known thanks to Harry Potter, the movie, but mandrake was one of these magic plants, and we may think that some of the episodes in the Iliad or the Odyssey are based on the use of these plants. The most famous one is the story of Circe. And so it might be the case that it has been demonized. But I don't think that there was really an insistence on the fact that some plants shouldn't be used. From the literature I work on, it seems that this was more open. The approach wasn't too much prohibitive. I don't think so. But once again, it depends. That's history. It depends on the available documentation. If all of a sudden we have a manuscript which comes out from a library and provides new information, we might have to change our approach.
Mm-hmm. And something like mandrake, do we know what that plant is today?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
And I had the pleasure of seeing one 5 years ago in Crete. In December, I was walking in the ancient castro of the city, and all of a sudden I was in front of a mandrake, and then I looked better, and I found tons of mandrakes in this place. And so we know perfectly what it is. That's not a problem.
And so that's a plant that is native to that area, and it's not naturalized in the American soils.
It is. No, let's say there is quite a wide circulation of plants, and already in antiquity, plants circulated worldwide, even though at that time the world was much more limited than it is now, known world, but sailors, traders circulated with the plants for several reasons, trade, but also because they brought with them the plants they use for therapeutic purposes, for example, not to find themselves in a situation in which they wouldn't have had any remedies. And so there is quite a circulation of plants, and we are working on that because it's a very interesting question for biodiversity. And the material to study this kind of problem are the shipwrecks. And there are really thousands of shipwrecks in the Mediterranean. And unfortunately, water sometimes made them sink, but at the same time, water preserved this material. And right now, we are engaged in a new research program which consists in analyzing with the DNA sequencing and identification, analyzing these remains of plants from shipwrecks. And this is a very promising field of investigation, very new, very promising.
And so people wanted to carry their medicines with them so they wouldn't be without their remedies. What types of medicines have been found on these shipwrecks? Which types of plants and to treat what types of ailments?
Yes, that's a research which we've concluded recently. An agreement between the Smithsonian Institution, the Institute for the Preservation of Medical Traditions, which I have created within the Smithsonian to carry on specifically this kind of research on the history of botany and ancient medicinal plants. So Smithsonian on the one hand, the Institute for the Preservation of Medical Traditions on the other hand, and also partnership with the Italian Department of Antiquities. Because in 2002 I discovered that archaeologists in excavating one of these shipwrecks have found something they thought were medicinal tablets. And so we could get fragments of these tablets at the Smithsonian, and we made a DNA analysis. And surprisingly, the result was that these tablets were made out of very common plants. Carrots, garlic, broccoli, onions, parsley, so very simple plants. And this is very interesting because it was a proof that there is a deep relationship between food and medicines,
mm-hmm.
and also that these people on the ships had with them some medicine. The question was to know, of course, whether this medicine were for sale or for use by the sailors on the ship. But when I compared the results of this DNA analysis with my databases, because I've databased all these texts of pharmacology and botany, and so when I compared the results and my databases, the common denominator to all these substances is the treatment of gastric, of the gastric system, problem of the stomach and the digestive system. Mm. And so it's my hypothesis that the sailors had some medicine on board, because everybody knows that in the past and until recently, gastric and digestive problems were quite something on ancient ship because of the lack of vitamins. And so I assume, or I hypothesize, that sailors had always on board a pharmacy with some medicines for possible troubles of sailors during their journey.
Very interesting. Now, how do you figure out when you hear of a plant that's mentioned in a text that has a common name, how do you understand what plant that is? Because so many plants may have a similar common name, or you may have the same plant that has two different common names. How do you sort through that?
Yes, this is a fundamental question, and you're totally right in asking. And that's where the databases get into the play. What we do within the Institute for the Preservation of Medical Traditions is going around the world to find texts in libraries, texts which some of which are known and published in printed versions, so that you can buy them in a good university library, but also texts which are totally unknown or overlooked. People have never either opened these manuscripts or taken the time to publish these texts. And so my job consists in going around the world to find these texts, to transcribe them from manuscripts. And when I say manuscripts, I really mean books written by hand before printing. So the books which the ancient physicians have produced to keep their knowledge and also to record their own experience. And once we have transcribed these texts on computer, we database them, which means that we extract the information, the plant name, the uses of the plant, etc. And so we have all the possible information with all the possible names, and we can always connect these different names in one way or another in order to establish the correspondences between the several names. And we are helped, because this problem was already acute in antiquity in the Middle Ages, and the ancient physicians themselves produced lexica of these plant names, the dictionaries of plant names. And on top of that, we have also the representation of the plants in the manuscripts to be sure that these people were talking about the same plant. They also included illustrations in some of their books. And so in these illustrations, very often, we have several names. For example, mandrake, in the north of Greece, it's called that way. In the Aegean islands, it's called that way. In Asia Minor, it's called that way. The Egyptians call it that way. The Romans, that way, etc. And so when we sum up all this information, we can establish table of correspondences, and we can link that with a description of a plant, the effects, and possibly also an illustration. It acts exactly what we do in the Institute for the Preservation of Medical Traditions. We sum up all this information, we screen it, and we generate for each plant a monograph which includes possibly all the names we find in the ancient documentation, the description, the therapeutic effect, and the representation. And so on the basis of this sum of information, we can come up with a plausible identification.
What methods of delivery were utilized for these plant medicines? Were people preparing them in alcohol extracts as we do today, or were they making teas or making salves?
There were several ways of administering them, depending first on internal or external usage. Internal, oral ingestion, they usually made some mixture which could have been an infusion, decoction with some liquid which supposedly should have been inert, which means no active properties. That's not the case of water, but very often it was vinegar or also wine and oil. And so with wine, we have also some alcohol, even though it wasn't alcohol in the meaning, in the contemporary meaning of the word. Let's say there was already some form of alcohol, because as you know, alcohol has been developed in the Arabic world with the process of distillation. But in the Greek world, wine is already some form of alcohol. And for external use, they made plasters, creams, and amalgamation of plants, and also sometime also the raw plant itself. And even now, in Italy, for example, when you are stung by a bee, people put a leaf of tomato on the point where you have been stung. So sometimes it might be the raw plant as such, fresh, on your skin. So it's quite differentiated, let's say, according to the use, internal or external, and according to the target.
And for something that's a plaster, could you describe what that would consist of, the preparation of a plaster?
Oh, yes. The basis was either some clay, but sometimes also it was a more disgusting natural product, like excrements of an animal, mm-hmm. and they mixed these bases with plants and also possibly some liquid, honey also, for example. And the idea is to have a paste at the basis. In the case of excrements, to have matter which is hot to provoke revulsion, and in the case of honey, to have something sticky to keep all these ingredients together and to make it flexible and workable, let's say, to have something well homogeneous. But the idea is to have something that you can spread easily on the skin, that could be almost glued on the skin, that amalgamates several ingredients.
Let me make an announcement to the listeners that if you have any questions and you'd like to call in and ask a question, the phone number here is 859-4200, and that's area code 315-859-4200. How are herbs preserved for seasons when that particular plant was unavailable? Was there any of that taking place?
That's a very interesting question. And I have worked a lot on this point, because indeed we are thinking of seasons and possible unavailability of plants. But ancient people knew perfectly nature, and they knew how to prevent this problem. And so in the ancient treatises, when you have a prescription, so for example, use plant A to treat this ailment, you then have a series of phrases. And if you don't have A, use B. And if you don't have B, use C. And if you don't have C, use D, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
And so scholars have always been wondering what that is, this kind of uncertainty, it seemed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really seems to say, use whatever you have. But when you analyze that more closely, you discover that these alternate plants are in fact plants which grow in different seasons.
Oh,
and so
wow.
There you understand that what you have actually is a constant replacement option. If you don't have that one because it's not the season, use that one because it's the season. And so there is this constant principle, this flexibility, let's say, and it seems to be a fuzzy set of data, but it's not at all. And so it's a very smart way of doing to constantly adapt the treatment according to the season.
What were some of the common ailments needing to be addressed by herbalists during these early time periods?
That's another very interesting question. Congratulations for asking all the good questions.
Thank you.
You have studied before. Because we have made a research on that. One of the questions I have always been asking is, what is the epidemiology of the ancient world, which is another way of formulating your questions. What were the ailments ancient physicians had to deal with? And we don't have any epidemiological data for antiquity. We don't have a CDC, Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, which records all possible cases of all possible diseases in the world, be this disease is rare or not. And so that's how these people in the decades before the end of the century were able to detect HIV, for example, because they saw appearing cases of, at the very beginning, isolated cases of rare diseases. But so we don't have anything like that for the ancient world. And so what I have made is something rather different. I have taken all the texts I work on, plants and diseases, and I have calculated how many plants we have for each category of diseases on the basis of the following reasoning. The more frequent a disease, the higher the number of agents to treat it.
Mm.
And I have verified that this principle works. I have done that on 20th century therapeutics, and it seems it works. And so on that basis, I spent an entire month doing nothing else than calculating the data in ancient treatises. I didn't reply to email, nothing, no telephone call, nothing, just working on these ancient works. And I came up with a table of frequency of ancient diseases. And so the first and most important, it seems, category of pathologies was the skin diseases, all possible affections of the skin. Second, the digestive system. Third, the urinary tract. And fourth, gynecology. And so these numbers may change, of course, but it seems that this order of importance, skin, digestive, urinary, and gynecology, may be quite a solid approach. And I've shown that to modern physicians, colleagues, and when they saw that, they told me, of course, that's exactly what we still have now. And so it seems that the ancient epidemiology may be quite consistent with modern epidemiology, which is quite an important conclusion because it also validates the use of the information in ancient texts for contemporary medicine. So there could have been quite a continuity in humankind, the diseases and health.
Hmm. Have you come across evidence of herbal birth control methods?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There, as much as you want, I would even say. And there are two ways, prevention of conception and also abortifacient. There are many of these agents in the ancient texts, and so it seems that it was absolutely normal practice.
And does it seem that these products would have had a good efficacy?
Yes. Prevention of conception consisted mainly either in maintaining an inflammation in the vagina to create a barrier for the sperm, or to introduce into the vagina produce which obturate the cervix. So that's one thing. And the abortifacients are hemorrhagic agents, which technically they are not abortifacients. They are much more dangerous than just an abortifacient. But indeed, they provoke an abortion. So technically, these people knew how to manage these situations. And it's clear in the case of the prevention of conception that this is, let's say, women's business, that there is a living tradition there.
Are there any plants that you have come across in the texts where their use is something that's surprisingly different, where it had changed. Originally, it was used for primarily for one condition, and then later people began using it for something completely different?
Yes and no. It's a little bit a difficult question to answer straight, because what we see when we observe these texts over a very long period of time, we see gradual adjustments, small modifications of the in the use of these plants, be it the condition for which the plant is used, on the way to use the plant. And so there is a constant validation, clinical trial, let's say, and verification of the uses of the plants. There are some uses which are abandoned. For example, coriander was used for the treatment of psychological troubles. I don't know of any physician who would use that plant for these kind of medical conditions. But more than surprising uses which have been abandoned, there is a constant validation, adjustment, refining to get more efficiency. That's one thing. The other thing is that we have abandoned the use of plants mainly at the beginning of the 20th century, because until the work of a German pharmacochemist named Paul Ehrlich, the core substances of therapeutics was made of plants. And so it's only in the 20th century that plants have been substituted with pharmacochemical agents. And so it seems, rather than a radical change in the use of plants, we've simply lost these uses of plants. But every single time we are able to verify the uses of the plants, the more research goes ahead, the more the ancient uses are correct. And so it's more a question of rediscovering and reaccepting this whole body of knowledge than having huge mistakes or misuses.
How did people in these times, I guess this is maybe a speculative question, how did they find out which plants are used for which ailments?
That's once again a very important question. Really, congratulations. To go to the point, technically, we don't know. And so there is this general hypothesis that humankind, reproduced the behavior of animals. But that's an hypothesis which is not validated in any way. There are different hypotheses on the origin of the knowledge of the therapeutic properties of plants. One, for example, is that medicinal plants are weeds. Another one is that medicinal plants are all plants with very visible characteristics. For example, poppy. Poppy is a red flower, and then it becomes this capsule, which is indeed very visible. In order to try to make some progress on this question, in our databases, we have included the characteristic, botanical characteristic of the plants and any other element that we find in the text. So the characteristics we have in our databases are not those of contemporary botany, but of ancient botany, let's say the way ancient people saw these plants. And so we are trying to see if we can find a correlation between the ancient description of the plants and their properties. And for example, the perfect case is all the plants with a yellow flower are used for liver trouble, because bile is considered to be yellow, this kind of association. But we are working on that, and right now this is an open question.
Mm-hmm. How did aspiring herbalists of the time learn the craft?
By going in the field. Let's say these people, as kids, were living in the family. They saw the mother, and probably also the grandmother, practicing this kind of medicine. And when they were kids, they probably went in the field with their father, or a grandfather, and you know how it works. You walk, and the senior, the elderly, tell you, oh, look there, there is that plant, haha, what is it made for, etc. You start this kind of dialogue in the families, and then if you were more motivated, when you were a teenager, you went with a physician whom you followed for years and years, assisting him in treating the patients, saying what were the cures, writing down what you thought was important, creating and developing step-by-step your own therapeutic book, and these are the manuscripts that we have. And so it was more a slow process of assimilation by participating in the treatment of patients with a senior physician rather than an apprenticeship in a short period of time or a study in a couple of years, maybe a little bit more, in a university. It was really a hands-on experience.
Was it a male or female-dominated tradition or neither?
We don't know. The traditional historiography is that this was a gendered male tradition with a female component in the families. And once again, I've made a study on that to try and elucidate this question. And the result is that when you see that most of the plants that were used as medicines are also food, you implicitly conclude that there is a deep link between family management and medicine. And I have mentioned this idea that these medicinal plants come out of the orchard. And so this is clearly gendered, female gendered. And so in the families, it seems that it might be the case that medicine was in the hands of a female, but that learned medicine, official medicine, written medicine was more of a male business. So there might have been a gender cut, let's say, of the field into real practice and knowledge, codified knowledge.
So that would maybe be parallel to the cultural example of men who cook food are chefs, women who cook food are wives.
Exactly.
So it's the same kind of thing repeating itself.
Possibly. But let's say, I wouldn't write that, but, and in the case we need to verify it, but let's say it might be this kind of divide indeed.
Mm-hmm. Who had access to the herbalism? Was it, you know, only for nobles and elites, or all types of people?
No, it seems that it was for all types of people. And here, that the problem of history, when you work on historical documents, you have to work with what you have. And this is the reason why I don't work only on antiquity, but I have pushed the limits of the field up to modern times. And here there is something very special we need to mention. In the Greek world, the Greek-speaking world, this kind of tradition, medical tradition, has lasted until late in the 19th century. And so the Greek-speaking communities in the Ottoman Empire reproduced by hand their medical knowledge really until late in the 19th century and sometimes even in the early 20th century. And so there we can study, we can see more closely who was practicing medicine, and it doesn't seem that this was an elite thing. Let's say, once again, there are two levels. There is the high level, rhetorical treatises, elaborated theories and things like that, but there are also all these notebooks of physicians, and these notebooks are not at all elite. This is part of the family. And in Greece now, you still have these notebooks in the families. It's called iatrosophion, which means medicine in Greek. And you still have the medicine book, just as you have the recipe book of grandma. So for the pie here, the apple pie or the recipe for the turkey for Thanksgiving, you have also the recipe book for the house medicines.
Mm. One moment, I have a call.
Yeah.
Caller wants to know if there's any basic differences between how herbalism grew up in the West as compared to the East, because they have different ideas of energetics in the body.
That's a very good question. We should first define East and West, but assuming that we can, there is research going on the question of relationships between East and West. And this is a hot question right now in history of medicine. And here again, the shipwrecks are very useful for that, because we have proved that these ships, as early as the Bronze Age, carried plants from the Near East, certainly, and possibly also from the Far East. And so there were relationships. And the most important question on this point is to know whether Greek medicine was influenced by Egyptian medicine. And traditionally, historiography has said no, because there was this idea that Greek medicine was an achievement rather independent from any external influence. Now, the trend is toward an interdependence of East and West, the Near and the Far East and the Mediterranean. But indeed, they have different conceptions of the body. But here, talking about plants, what is really important is the efficacy of these plants and the way the activity of the plants was translated in order to correspond to the theories about the body and physiology. And so, even though the systems may have been different, they are not necessarily incompatible. And bottom line, there are indeed many exchanges between East and West. And sometimes also these exchanges go in the opposite way we would think. And for example, thanks to a colleague who works on Chinese medicine, I have discovered a manuscript in Chinese in which we have Arabic terms of medicinal plants, and significantly, these names of medicinal plants have not been translated neither into Chinese, not even nor in Arabic. These are the plant names in Greek, which have been written from the Greek alphabet into the Arabic alphabet, and these Arabic names written in Arabic alphabet have been kept as such in the Chinese text and written with the Arabic letters in the Chinese text. So let's say the exchanges were multidirectional, and the differences, conceptual differences, didn't prevent these exchanges.
Just to go back to when you talked about cumin being used for people's mental problems, I've heard in Chinese medicine, schizophrenia is thought to be caused from too much mucus in the heart.
Yep.
And so this would be, then you would treat it with some type of a mucus decongestant?
Yes.
Is that something that's still commonly practiced, or that's fallen by the wayside?
No, let's say that's no longer practiced exactly that way. But let's say here the idea is that mental disturbance is provoked by an excess of some substance in your organism, wherever you place the mental and psychological faculties. And so the major idea is that mental problems are the result of an obstruction of some of your functions. And so what I think is that this is some figurative, some sort of metaphor, let's say, of the mental disturbance. You have a mental problem because on something you have an obstacle. which prevent the normal exercise of your faculty. And so in some systems, you have to eliminate an excess of mucus in the brain. In other systems, in the heart, because it's the seat of the mental faculties, and in other systems, a different way. And so I think that here what we have is a poetical, let's say, a metaphor, a translation of the properties of the medicinal plants in a material system in order to make that understandable, perceivable. That's what I think is the basis of the theoretical discourses on medicinal plants.
Is there much mention in the texts of cannabis being used in the ancient world? And if so, what conditions did they use it for?
Yes, it is mentioned. For several conditions. Right now, I don't have them on top of my head, but let's say there are several conditions. On top of my head, I cannot tell you, but let's say it was used.
No problem.
We can post that on your website.
Okay. And were these plant sources that people were using for medicines mostly wild harvested, or were they cultivated?
Another very good question. They were harvested if we work with the idea that the plants for medicine and food were the same and they were in the orchard. So they were constantly using fresh plants. But on the other hand, they had plants which were cultivated and prepared to be kept. But we don't have very precise information, and we don't have physical evidence for that. So for the moment, it's a little bit an open question.
Will you give some examples of the sources of your research? What types of, where these manuscripts are from? And what?
Oh, yes. If you wanted to come with us to the Smithsonian and then to travel with us worldwide, you would know that. These manuscripts are preserved in all the great libraries in the world: British Library in London, National Library in Paris, Vatican Library, wherever, let's say, all the big Venice also, Rome, Naples, all the great collections of manuscripts. But you have them also in small, inaccessible places, small Greek monasteries in the mountains of the islands, and that's exactly the job we do. We go around the world tracing these manuscripts. Sometimes you need to be persistent because you arrive at this small Greek monastery in the afternoon and you have forgotten that the monk is doing a siesta, and so until 5 he doesn't open the door. It's part of the job, let's say. There is a police investigation, an inquiry component in the job, which is on the one hand difficult because you never know if you'll get the information, but on the other hand it's also fascinating because there is always some sort of challenge, and so you want to make it, and so it makes our life exciting daily.
I've heard a story of a class that was doing wild edibles, and they went out and collected these different foods, and some students had collected poison hemlock accidentally and included it into a salad.
That's a real problem. There are very famous examples of that. And even in antiquity, is the expedition, the Greek expedition to Persia. On their way back from Persia to Greece, they ate honey, which had been produced on a certain plant, and which is toxic. And so the soldiers had serious digestive troubles, and some died of that. And this is still a problem now. Another very famous example is some French soldiers who, at the beginning of the 20th century, ate aconiton instead of onions because the shape of the plant is exactly the same. So that's a constant problem, to be able to verify that the plants are exactly those which you need. And in the current increased use of medicinal plants, it's a real problem, because many times plants coming from abroad are not the ones you expect them to be. And so in order to make money, these producers sell you whatever plant they find instead of the ones you are expecting. And so this is a constant problem, the correct identification of the plants for medicines and standardization, of course.
Well, to continue the story, they had put the they had two salads, and some of the students had eaten from the one without poison hemlock, and some of them ate from the one with poison hemlock. Now, one student from each group, they both exhibited these classic symptoms of hemlock poisoning, but one of them didn't eat the plant. And so there's some speculation that it was the fear and hysteria that caused the actual symptoms of the hemlock poisoning. And so the people who were leading the class, the teachers, went out and gathered more of the poison hemlock, and they ate small amounts of it just to test its toxicity. And they said they ate just about the whole stalk of the thing and didn't experience any ill effects. Have you ever heard of poison hemlock not actually being poisonous?
That depends on the field, the field being the physiology of the patient. And what you are referring to is exactly the reverse effect of the placebo effect, just like you can experience the therapeutic effect of a plant because you are stimulated, suggested, etc. You can also have the toxic effect of a plant for the same reasons. That's one point. The second point is that the reactions to whatever therapeutic agent, even pharmacochemical agents, may differ from one individual to another. And this is why in the contemporary system of validation of new medicines, clinical trials need to be done on a high number of patients to be sure that we eliminate any possible interference of any external factor which would lead to a different appreciation of the effects of a substance. But what you're referring to is highly probable and can be explained, let's say, in different terms, indeed.
So do you think that there's any possibility that over time the names for poison hemlock and water hemlock got switched?
Of course. We have signs of that in the ancient text. Sometimes, indeed, you have the same genus of plants with a different species, which are switched, of course, yes. Yeah. That's very possible.
In your research, have you come across any herbal recommendations for pets, for people taking care of either pets or livestock using herbs?
Oh, yes. In the ancient medicine, there wasn't that separation, differentiation between human and veterinary medicine. This was one world. And so people were living with the animals, which sometimes might have been a source of troubles, of course, because there could have been diseases transmitted from animals to humans. And we have had that recently with these epidemics of swine flu, for example. But so this community between humans and animals led, of course, to similarities in the medicine also. And this information about treating animal disease is also present in manuals for human diseases.
Would you speculate that, or do you have any evidence that the witch hunts that took place were particularly people who were against herbal knowledge?
This was more of a medieval thing. In antiquity, we don't have trace of that. But this is typical of the Middle Ages. And here, we should be very careful in discussing that, because we need first to eliminate this idea of Middle Ages equal Dark Ages. This is a wrong historiographical concept. These were not Dark Ages at all. These people had knowledge, they were rational, and they knew what they were doing. But having said that, There was indeed during the Middle Ages witch hunt, let's say, which is in fact an attempt to prevent non-rational uses of medicines. And so there was there were attempts to prevent people to get out of the main rational stream. That's exactly the object.
Mm-hmm. And was there opposition from the Christian Church to the herbal medicines?
No. When we study the evolution and transmission of knowledge through time, which is what we do, because I've mentioned to you that we don't work only on antiquity, but we go up to the end of the 17th century, we see that in the early Christianity world, early Christian world, the church absorbed completely the ancient knowledge, which was very compatible with the message of Christ of compassion and sympathy with nature. And so there is an absorption of all this knowledge, but a transformation of the source of knowledge, instead of being a human knowledge discovered by trials and errors, it's a revelation. And we have two figures who are representative of these movements, which are the Saint Cosmas and Damianus, who were during the late antiquity, Middle Ages, the patrons of physicians, surgeons, and pharmacists. And right now, they are still the patrons of pharmacists. And so, through this absorption of ancient knowledge and the transformation of the source of knowledge, there is a deep continuity between, let's say, pagan and Christian, the pagan and Christian worlds.
What's the oldest text that you've come across?
The oldest text is, in classical antiquity, the series of writings attributed to Hippocrates, 5th, 4th century, but we know that Hippocrates didn't write, and so it's written by his followers and his school, let's say, but between quotation marks, school. But there are older texts, for example, the Egyptian papyri, 16th century B.C. What is important here is not the ancient texts, but the ancient knowledge in these texts, and the kind of work we do in the Institute for the Preservation of Medical Traditions is to do the archaeology of the knowledge in the text, and we try to see if we can find who created and how this knowledge has been developed. And so from the most ancient texts, we go backward in time, and we try to arrive to the source of knowledge, how this knowledge was gained, created, generated, and then transmitted from one generation to another.
And what is the most surprising information that you've come across in your research?
I would say there are many of these surprises. Every single time you open a manuscript, there is a surprise. Let's say opening a manuscript is like opening a case. You have an information, and you have to find what it is about, where it comes from, and who wrote it down. And let's say one which is very typical of the kind of work we do, in an 11th century manuscript, 11th century AD, of course, manuscript, you have a representation of cinnamon. And so you would think to have a plant drawn, something realistic. But it's very typical, because when you look closely at this representation, you see that the trunk of the tree is in fact a stick of cinnamon, which has been put vertically with on top of it some green thing in order to represent the leaves. And so when you examine that more closely, you understand that the artist didn't know the plant and tried to figure out what it could have looked like. And so, without any knowledge of the plant, he invented something, a stick of cinnamon, straight in the ground with some green stuff on top of it. And so, that's very interesting, because it shows that these artists knew the spies, but not the plant. And so it was quite a surprise, let's say, to see this gap between the knowledge of nature and the use of the product. But there are lots of small surprises like that in our daily life.
Elaine, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
You are most welcome. It has been a pleasure, and we hope to see you in Washington to come and work with us.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Oh, yes, you are most welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.